Start of interview with Dr. S. A. Wickramasinghe, 27th of July, 1967.
I want to ask you what you thought of the civil service of those days, you know, 1930s, 1940s, and even the early 1950s. The civil service of British traditions, how did it strike you?
Impression, but it had various aspects. One was our struggle against policy, which was implemented by the civil service. Had the response from the, had the support from the nationalist leaders, although our politically and our policies were different from the nationalists, but in the struggle against the
imperialist
you know, bureaucracy, they had we had their support generally. On the other hand, on questions of pure approach, scientific approach, bring to bear to mind, you know, the scientific approach to a problem. The British civil servant often, in the context of a narrow framework, he was impartial and had a scientific approach.
If not, for instance, from your knowledge of the ages of Martha Rasay, whom you would have met and known more than other men, other officials, would you say that they knew something about the conditions in the villages and could represent some of the needs of the villages?
Fundamentally, their approach was unrelated to the real problem of the villages. Their approach was more from the approach and the needs of a plantation economy, capitalist agriculture commercial crops. I think not capitalist agriculture in relation to food production. So it had a limited, basically anti-national approach, in the sense everything was thought in terms of plantation economy.
But that speaking generally, isn't it? Say, with regard to Tangal area, where there were hardly any plantation crops, certain parts of Mathura, this aspect wouldn't have come in specific cases. You would have been dealing with villagers and food production.
Now, earlier, you know, there were attempts at reviving some local industry, craftsmen, you know, the village blacksmith. But they did not carry it to the logical end of interfering at the central government level to protect them from foreign competition. The import of foreign the British manufactured articles, they never thought of restricting in order to protect the
local industry.
The local industry. they would look, they would approach, they would have a sympathetic approach to the local Brahmins, but actually their approach is one of basic hostility to the craftsmen, because they didn't agree to the protection from the real enemy, that is large-scale modern manufactured goods from outside, and did not go into this question of the economic problems involved. Mm-hmm. Neither would they attempt to modernize the local craftsmen methods. Nor would they give protection to the primitive handcraft methods of the local craft. But they had sympathy for him, people who are eking out an existence, who are producing some useful articles, and generally cheaper than the imported article, but did not go into the whole, when looking backwards, they did not go into the whole question, and they saw gradually all the village cottage industries gradually getting wiped out because of the inrush of imported articles.
You mentioned the impartiality of the civil servants. Would you class that as an asset, the impartiality and even perhaps integrity?
You see, impartiality in a relative way, with self-government and with independence, you have partiality to political parties in power. Earlier, there was partiality to the feudal class and to the richer class in power. And that was considered not partiality in the sense, general accepted position was people in affluent circumstances had a better standard of morality. That was the accepted, even the lower classes accepted this position until recently, when political organization, trade union organization, we were able to, generally the class consciousness of the people were roused, and gradually the new approach, now earlier appointments, hardly a person from the working class or the peasantry, however his claims on from point of view education, his chances were extremely poor. And of course the European civil servant would have a better attitude than a local civil servant, but still the sense of values, even for the foreign future, the prevailing class prejudice.
Mm-hmm. If there was a case between an European and a civil and a citizen, an administrative case, was there partial? There was there impartial? Wouldn't the European tend to favor the European?
Generally, one has to judge from incidents. Generally, there was the European was able to understand the difficulties of a European much more than he would understand the difficulties of a non-European. And generally, I think the as a in general, the European civil servants did indirectly persecute civilians who had any chance of national patriotism or regard for national culture. They were not given their due recognition.
Did you feel that the GAs of those days, GAs and AGAs, were independent types of men who were willing to take responsibility on their shoulders and even go against the secretariat if they considered it right.
That was a very...
Pardon?
It was a very rare situation. Generally, they preferred to conform to the prevailing traditions.
How dependent was the government of that day on the headman? I was wondering whether, in fact, headmen could often manipulate regulations and laws to suit their interests or to blunt a policy, to soften policy.
I first said, there was no enlightened policy. Policy was the interest of the, as I said, of the plantation economy. And generally, the and with regard to non-commercial crops, the big landowners and the headmen were all recruited from the basically landowning class. So generally the prevailing influence of the landed proprietors and who formed the headman class also, and the whole headman institution was based on that basis, including the mudir and the upper strata of the headman system. So, generally, the colonial framework was maintained, and any improvement came from the struggle of the people for more democratic rights. Now, for example, when the option was given for local government institutions to have elected bodies or continue the headman as the chief of the local government body, invariably they opted for the elected body in spite of the enormous influence that the headman and the chief headman had in the administration. The people, once they get the opportunity, they voted for the system of election for local government.
Looking at the civil service today, I was wondering what differences you noticed from those days.
Definitely, the civil servant is much more conscious of the fact that he has to respect public opinion. Where sometimes his decisions can be even against general interest because the prevailing public opinion he has to respect. So, as regards when he is faced with the absence of a strong enlightened policy by government, often he has to respect the prevailing public opinion rather than public policy. So, there is often problems arising where in place of good administration, you can get popular administration, which is not always synonymous with good administration.
Mm-hmm. But won't you say that the civil servant of today is more closely identified with the people?
Definitely. And he is conscious of the fact that his success depends on the positive cooperation from the people other than from his own administrative diktat.
Now, in those days, did the British civil servant or AGA tend to treat you as an MP of the area or other MPs with a certain amount of disdain as a queer breed or something like that? Did they?
Generally, they. Now, the first impact was that it was the form of a dyarchy that we had. Not full responsibility. The interests of the civil servants were protected by the chief secretary and the special powers of the governor general. And they made one feel that their opinion will ultimately will prevail. And within those limitations, they were prepared to listen to us. They always made the popularly elected representative to feel that subject to the overall decisions by the administration, by the government, they listen to us and only give a hearing, not agree to adopt their policy to the wishes of the people or their representatives. That's right from the the state council level down to the smallest administration. That atmosphere prevails.
Oh, I see. That's very interesting. And then apropos of this new development and a closer identification of the people with the people after independence, hasn't the impartiality and integrity also declined? One improvement, but
that is true. I mean, there is, as I mentioned at first, that with the attempt at popular administration has also meant undue influence, corruption, inefficiency, and absence of clear policy have all crept in. Repeated change of policy, not strict implementation of policy. Now, to give one example, now say the question of land conservation and reservations of streams, you know, to prevent erosion and safeguard the perennial streams in various city areas. When landlessness, people are facing landlessness and they encroach on this, the government, realizing the need to protect this, would not take steps to protect them because of the popular agitation by the elected representatives and even the ministers.
So in a sense, haven't the politicians themselves, as an average MP, contributed to this by putting various popular pressures, by making representations on behalf of groups of their constituents, and interference of a sort?
That is quite correct. I put it basically the underlying reason being that in our popular agitation, there has never been an approach of having a clear policy decision first and then trying to educate the people on the need to convince the people of a correct policy which is to the best interest of the nation and the people in particular of in a district, rather than we try to discover what the people are agitating for, what the immediate wishes of the people are, and try to and consider democracy being taking the lead from the people without any relation to the need to educate the people on the correct policy.
So, if I leave that subject and go back to the early days, late 30s, I didn't ask you last time about the pre-war split. I was wondering how many left the LSS people and formed the United Socialist Party. Very roughly.
Majority of the paying membership, the card membership, joined the United Socialist Party.
And within the sort of executive committee of the SSP, central committee, how many left?
The central committee, only a minority left. But the LSSP delayed calling a congress which the members had the right to demand, because the majority of the membership who had the full membership as card-holding members, they delayed holding the special congress because of the fact that the rank and file membership will be in the majority with those who formed the USP subsequently. And of course subsequently when the party was banned by the government, question, we need a right, you see.
I don't know if this is a secret, but I was wondering who the, which members of the central committee left at that stage. I know you were there, was M.J. Mendis also?
Yes, myself, M.J. Mendis. Then there was we two were the only members in the central committee. The others who left were
party members.
The overwhelming majority of the central committee were
Trotskyites. Why did you call the party United Socialist Party rather than Communist Party, as you did later on?
Originally, we thought if we call ourselves the Communist Party, we'd be banned.
You would be banned?
Yes. And even the Santamaja Party, but originally would have been the Communist Party if we did not anticipate some obstacle from the government. Subsequently, as the USP was banned, we thought the best thing is to take the offensive without any pretense of broad political consequences.
What was Vaidyanathan's influence at this time? Was he within the Trot group or the Stalin group, your group?
I wouldn't call he had a Stalin group in any sense. We were he was strongly anti-Trotsky.
I thought so.
Yes. He was in our group. But he was, at the time of the split, he was not in Chile. He was in Cambridge. He was a student. He came during the war, he returned to Chile. And was with him.
No, I know that he wrote something, so I presume that because of his Cambridge background and all that, he would have been considered one of the writers and of the party.
When he came back after study, he more or less took to full-time party activity for some until he became a teacher. He was doing full-time party
work. He didn't have any influence on the discussions within the party after the war on Baudelarist lines and then...
Well, on those matters, I think it's not proper for me to make any internal problems of the party.
No, I was thinking of his influence as a writer, you see. I was also interested in your period of cooperation with Philip Goodwater from 51 to 55. Who initiated the United Front?
I think it was mutual.
Mutual?
Yes. In fact, we were always for an overall unity of the left.
Yes.
Right throughout. Even with the split, we were fighting for agreement on the maximum basis on which we could have a common agreement and work on the basis of the common factors which we could agree on, and not emphasize the points on which we disagree, and then therefore, because the basic need was, the urgent need was the unity of the left against imperialism, against imperialism.
No, I was wondering who initiated it. So you said it was mutual.
Yes. And when we found that at least there was one group of the left which had split, was agreeable to the United Front, naturally, I would.
Yes. What were the, in the 40s and 50s and up to 60s, so, what were the obstacles to this general left unity?
One was the Sangh Samaj Party. Refused to accept the United Front with any broad building up of a broad national front, anti-imperialist front. They believed in working class party setting up a socialist government overnight. That they thought that the policy of the Communist Party was anti-Marxist and reformist. That is, our attitude was that we have to go in stages. That is, first the national democratic revolution in the sense of getting the anti-imperialist nationalist elements and form a government which is not socialist, and where the socialist parties are not in full power but cooperating with other broad anti-imperialist forces. Some Samaj Party did not accept it. They thought Ceylon was in a position to establish, the working class was in a position to establish a working class government, a Samaj Party. So there was this basic approach. So we wanted to, although we characterized the National Congress as pro-imperialist, we were for cooperating with nationalist groups outside the National Congress, patriotic elements within the country, and forming a broad government. Even after the 1947 election, we were for a broad left government with dissenting groups of the National Congress, and to form a government which is anti-imperial.
But I thought for a while Abhay Gunawardhan and his group were against that even, within the party, just for a little while.
Yes. They were for, the permanent revolution struggle, and continue the struggle, and be through struggle that the organization will develop by every possible opinion should be taken for trade union disputes, for struggling with the peasantry, struggling in the plantations, and that the mass struggle should be organized everywhere, and parliamentary approach, they completely turned their back.
Now, when this unity talks were held, what was the LSSP line? They wanted.
That time the LSSP line was that they were looking forward to winning at the polls the overall majority and forming a socialist government.
Oh, I see.
And reduced to ordinary terms. That was their attitude. Then another obstacle was we were against open criticism of the Soviet Union. Although Soviet Union had difficulties and they had problems to overcome, and there were even certain incorrect policies, our policy was that Soviet Union, internal problems of the Soviet Union will be tackled by the Soviet Union. It is not in the interest of the world socialist movement to denigrate the socialist union in public. So we were against any approach, critical approach, except internally a critical appraisal of the policy of the Soviet Union in relation to our policy. But of course, the Samasamajis not only thought that they should have the right to openly condemn and criticize the Soviet Union, they thought that our approach meant complete subservience to the Soviet policy, which was entirely untrue. And also they had the attitude that fundamentally the Soviet policy internationally was wrong. Internationally and essentially their policy was wrong, and they accepted the Trotsky's line of the need for a overall change in the political leadership of the Soviet Union.
I was wondering whether the Samasamajis were also frightened that they would lose some of their card-holding members to the Communist Party.
I couldn't.
Haven't they, in the process of the 50s and 40s, in fact, lost some members to,
yes,
to the party?
Yes, they have been, that has been steadily, they have been losing a large percentage of their cadre. In fact, some of the most active cadres in the Communist Party were those who were, at the beginning, were left.
At this point, the original spool was reversed. The interview is continued.
Square bracket. I am afraid a portion of the interview was not recorded at this stage. The following is the gist of the conversation that has been missed. I have made this summary immediately after the interview by speaking into the mic. Close brackets. I remark that Philip has made the complaint that during their United Front days, 51 to 55, he lost some of his party members to the Communist Party. Dr. Vikramasinghe laughed and gave the equivocal answer that Philip makes wild statements nowadays. With regard to the breakup of the United Front, I forget what factor he presented as a chief cause of the breakup. However, I know that I remarked that I inquired whether the language issue hadn't contributed to this incident. He agreed and said that Philip had adopted the Shaolinistic policy, and wanted Sinhalese domination. In fact, he had wanted Sinhalese domination within the party, and wanted Tamil members removed from positions of influence. He had even questioned Peter Kenneman's role, said that Peter Kenneman was not a Sinhalese. My next question pertained to this Communist Party policy towards SLFP. I inquired whether in the period 52 to 56 there were more pro-SLFP than pro-LSSP, that is to say, were closer to the SLFP. Replying, he said that of course those days the SLFP was weak and not a force to be reckoned with. In economic policies, they were actually closer to the Samajis. But politically, they had tended to be closer. It was true that they had been tended to be closer to the SLFP. I inquired what the attitude had been to the SLFP government between 56 and Banda's death in 59. He said that they favored this government. In fact, they came close to coalescing with Banda Nayaka government. But they were prevented from doing so by one of the 10 points made in the Ten Commandments, the Dasapanatha. That is to say, the Ten Commandments proposed by the SLFP. One of the principles was that they were against communism and fascism, in effect equating the two. This the CP were not willing to accept, and therefore they did not coalesce. However, their policy was that of cooperation, of supporting the government, were consistent with their policies. As typist, for continuation of this comment, see end of interview and end of comments around about number 375380. It was run out of time. I was talking about the port unions. How did he disrupt?
Now, our policy was, being a government which we considered a progressive government, which was overall influence was anti-imperialist, and a government which would help to complete the political independence and establish economic independence. On policy, we did not want to embarrass the government economically. Our unions were not prepared to take every opportunity to strike at the government by calling strikes, even with dissatisfaction of the workers. I mean, we had primarily to protect the interests of the workers. At the same time, we considered we had the interest of the overall national interest of the country in forcing the government to adopt a hostile attitude to the trade unions. But whenever there was a trade union dispute, Philip often would refuse negotiations, use his influence to prevent negotiations with our unions. And he was prepared to harm our unions by refusing the demands, even at the risk of economic embarrassment to the government. He would try his best to prevent any trade union demands being won by our unions. You see, he had that very narrow sectarian approach.
So did this lead to strikes in the fort and in some other places?
Strikes in the fort and even the strike in the tea and rubber industry, the Colombo tea and rubber packing industry. On this and government servants strike, we could have brought out certain compromises with Mr. Bandaranaike if it were not for the hostile attitude of Philip Vinoga and his disruptive attitude. And in the harbour, he had thugs employed, and even the Benin market. He had the most dangerous criminals as union leaders, and he was able to use terrorist methods to prevent proper trade union functioning. And finally, in the Manning market, Felix Bandaranaike had to shift the stores to Weyangode, I think, somewhere. The position became so impossible that they had to shift the stores outside the Manning market. And some of Philip's men had quarrels among themselves, and there were gangsterism and several murders were committed.
And in 19... Oh, before that, what was your attitude to Philip's paddy land bill?
We had earlier advocated, since 1932, we had been advocating for the right of the undercultivated. And we had even agitation by persons in various areas on several locations. And we gave full support to the Paddy Lands Act in spite of its defects. And of course, in the government, Philip had to compromise to get the bill through.
But wasn't the right-wing opposition in the government not so much opposition of landlords as opposition to the fact that Philip was creating his own cultivation groups? He could appoint them.
It was both. There was the vested interest land owners opposition. Also, there was a political opposition by CPC Lakrav, not so much on the basis of land ownership. He didn't want the Paddy Lands Act to apply to lands under the Land Commission Department. That is about one third of the paddy cultivation area in the dry zone did not come under the Paddy Lands Act. Now all the areas where the colonists were settled were not brought into the Paddy Lands Act.
Turning to 1960 and the March elections, why was there no contest pact?
With
the SLFP and as in 56, why wasn't there a general no contest pact?
The SLFP at that time thought they can defeat the government on their own, come to power. The right wing of the SLFP would not agree to any agreement with the left, two left parties. They thought that the unpopularity of the SLFP was due to limited cooperation they had from the left party.
Oh, I
on,
see.
On various occasions.
So the SLFP wanted to go it alone.
Yes.
Didn't Samasamaj's relatives, that is the Enimparera crowd, also want to go on their own?
Yes. And the Samasamaj party also at that time, just as in 56, when they found that in 60 the SLFP was defeated, they thought that the people were, that was an indication that the people were convinced of the correctness of the policy of the LSSP, and that it was an indication the people wanted the LSSP in power. They misread the situation, and they were fully confident, both in 56 and 60, that they will form the government. And it was in the March 60 that they finally realized the utter futility of attempting to form a pure government of a left party.
Going back to 56 and this language issue, isn't it a fact that the Communist Party lost some members, some cardholding members, because of the language policy?
Yes. It was more, not so much of the chauvinist influence of certain members of the SLFP who had a leftist reputation, like Dhanayake.
Yes.
They became completely chauvinistic, and they were able to influence some members of the Communist Party, like Mahanam Samaravir.
No, I was thinking of, say, certain trade unions like the Jatika Guru Sangamaya, which was in under your party. It seems to have swung completely over to the chauvinistic line. A few words.
But generally, on its policy, a trade union policy, it did not. On the language issue, there were some of its members. As a trade union, you have to. It is only on economic policy that the members should conform to the decisions of the trade union. But on certain political issues, they had members of the United National Party, you know. On political issues, they can hold differences. It was only on trade union issues affecting the economic interest that they have to conform to the decisions of the union. The large section of the left elements within the Sri Lanka Freedom Party remained loyal and are still with the party. I mean, there was at the beginning a wave of Sinhalese chauvinism, one must admit, and based on hatred to the Tamil minority, and which was a hangover from long historical traditions of attempts at Tamil invasions of Ceylon and domination by the Tamil Empire at certain period, even during the early Portuguese period, of the danger of Tamil becoming the dominant language all over Ceylon.
And another sort of sideline drawing from the 50s, the 1959 Delimitation Commission. I wonder whether that affected your party fortunes, your constituent system, the changes they made.
The general changes, right throughout, you know, by having, more seats for the
Candian
areas on area rather than on population. Apart from the general position, 1959 did not adversely affect.
I was wondering whether they did anything to your seat in Dathureli area, that constituency, to affect your...
No, basically there has been no the decisions of the delimitation commission did not in any way adversely made much inroads into the interests of the left parties as such, except the overall principle which they waited for upcountry areas.
No, I was wondering whether because it was SLFP nominated, it tended to manipulate some constituencies to suit the SLFP interest.
Basically, I should say, on those matters when representations were made, we were able to get an impartial hearing. And generally, there I think there is not much room for criticism of the attitude of the Delimitation Commission on on that score.
I could come sort of further on to 1963. Was it when the Communist Party split into the two wings?
Yes, it was. I think the open split was about 63.
But it had been there for some time.
Since it was ready, building from 60. Maybe the international differences, the Chinese party
came from 60.
Yes.
Did the language problem contribute to this underlying split?
In fact, it is not a split in Ceylon. It was a small group splintered off and attempted to disrupt the party. And it was able to make noise because it had outside patronage. Especially finance.
Especially finance?
Yes.
How far did personal issues contribute to this splinter in a way?
Personally, I think because of personal issues, people become amenable to certain unhealthy influences. Especially financial advantage.
I don't know if this is a secret, but if I may ask, how many left the Central Council?
It's not a secret, about 5 or 6.
And how would you assess the strength of this group in membership at the moment?
Very insignificant. Now it has been reduced to, I think, 3 members of the Central Committee.
Have any who left then come back to the force?
Several trade union workers and a good number of rank and file have applied for membership again. And several are now politically inactive. And some have had personal differences with the leadership and either have left or have been interdicted by their leadership.
Of publicly known men, I was wondering whether you could give a few examples of publicly known people.
About a week ago, the Capital Express gave the names of a few who have been interdicted by Sanmugathasan. Jayasurya, Jinendra Pala, and one other, who were in the central committee of the new group.
Of the new group?
Yes. And on the trade union front, they captured the entire trade union organization when they formed a separate group. But now they have completely been isolated and there's only a nucleus of a trade union that is left with them.
What is Teja Gunawardena's role?
Teja Gunawardena has vital differences with Shanmugathasan's group. But they are both are still the common factory. They are both look for support from the Chinese Communist Party.
Mm-hmm. I never
and the Chinese embassy.
How do you present both, actually three people, Teja, Sanmugdasan and Kumarasiri, is it?
Kumarasiri and Sanmugdasan are totally opposed to each other. They challenge integrity, mutually they challenge each other's integrity. Teja Gunawardhan and Premalal are, you know, there is certain basis of support, I mean, on personal, subjective level, appears to be
together.
But Premalal definitely appears to be not working closely with Teja Gunawardhan either. But I am not in a position to give very much. And I don't think there are any political issues you can judge from the Cultural Revolution and the various statements that are being made by the followers of this Cultural Revolution. But their policy today seems to be that this group, both the groups, want to infiltrate into the Sri Lanka Freedom Party. So if it is a Cultural Revolution, condemning the Communist Party as revisionist to infiltrate into a non-Marxist party, it is difficult to judge a political orientation.
In fact, apart from that, I was asking about personal pictures because I was, for instance, what are the social origins of Kumarasiri and Premalal? Are they...
Premalal Kumarasiri is one man.
Kumarasiri. What is he, lower middle class or upper middle class?
Lower middle class.
Now, apart from his and the others, Chinese orientation, or so-called Chinese orientation, I was wondering whether there was anything else in their personal characters or in their orientation which led them to split. For example, were they chauvinistic minded? You know, I was wondering whether that contributed.
Men like Premalal Kumarasiri, coming from the lower middle class, and even intellectually of a limited
caliber.
Attempting to face up to bigger issues of a higher intellectual level, gradually, often meets with serious problems within an organized party. So naturally, this is an outlet where they can become masters in their own territory. Okay. And so that temptation probably made. And also, subjective factors like unlimited financial resources.
What helped them to seize control of the CTUF?
Well, Sanmugdasan has been able to pack the committee of the CTUF, and he was the main functionary of the trade union front in the party.
Before this.
And temporarily, he was able to, and the union's registration, you know, with the government, naturally the officials are recognized from the registration. And until we were able to form rival organization and claim the overwhelming majority of the membership in this union, we were unable to get official recognition from the government.
Have you got it back now?
In most of the unions, we have got it back. All the unions that matter now, we have re-established the party, the CFTU now.
The unions that matter?
Now all the unions in Colombo, yeah. The tea and rubber packing unions, which were the most well-organized unions, practically every one of them is back. Even in the CPB, the large majority have re-registered in our union. The harbor.
Didn't Shan and Kumarasiri have a strong influence in the youth league organization and use this to their advantage?
Just temporarily they had. But even there the situation has changed. Most of the youth league leaders who went over have come back.
What about the campus? Because I know one or two or three chaps who seem quite strong, Chinese wing.
But personally I think now, in the campus too, the party influence, and especially the international prestige of the Soviet Union and generally among the intellectuals, of general appreciation of activities of the socialist countries in the international field and locally of the Communist Party. I think now generally the situation has very much changed, except for a few irresponsible